This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran. Lawmakers in Connecticut and New York are taking steps to investigate and clean up toxic chemicals that have been found in the rivers and groundwater in our area. Let's start with Connecticut. This week, Governor Ned Lamont appointed a task force to look into PFAS chemicals in the state and develop a plan to reduce their impact on residents. PFAS is the family group of chemicals found in firefighting foam used in area airports. These chemicals have been linked to kidney cancer, reproductive problems, and other illnesses. Last month, about 50,000 gallons of water contaminated with PFAS spilled into the Farmington River from a private airplane hangar at Bradley International Airport. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut held a press conference on the banks of the Farmington River in June. He has sponsored an amendment to the federal defense funding bill that would help communities prevent, monitor, and dispose of PFAS. Senator Blumenthal joins us now. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Explain to us and give us an update on the Farmington River spill.
Evidently, the Farmington River spill has been fairly well contained, but as you know, these PFAS chemicals are forever. That is, they remain in the water, but also in surrounding soil, and they endure. They don't dissipate or degrade. And so there is a continuing threat to the drinking water, as well as to recreation and boating in the area. And we're hopeful that the amendment and eventually the law that I have sponsored will provide some assistance to communities. Certainly it will regarding drinking water, because it has $100 million authorized for helping to clean up drinking water, and hoping also that it will cover remediation of other kinds of contamination by declaring these PFAS chemicals as hazardous substances.
Yeah, let's backtrack a bit, because the EPA, many would say, has failed in regulating PFAS chemicals. Do you agree or disagree?
There is no question that EPA has failed. The Environmental Protection Agency of the federal government promised that it would designate PFAS compounds. And remember, there are more than 4,000 of them, and they differ somewhat, but all of them are highly toxic. And EPA promised in a PFAS action plan that it released in February of this year that it would designate these chemicals as hazardous substances, and therefore the areas contaminated could be part of Superfund sites. Now, it has also failed in preventive action, because fire services around the state still use these chemicals as fire suppressants. In other words, they use it to put out fuel and chemical fires, and there are apparently non-fluoride substitutes or alternatives that EPA should be supporting and funding for the fire services to adopt. So in a variety of different ways, the federal EPA has failed to do its job.
Because there is no Superfund money for these PFAS chemicals and remediation, how will that impact this?
If Superfund site funding is available, it will provide for the full cost of cleaning up any of the PFAS that have contaminated ground and soil around the hangar and the airfield or other areas of the state that may have been contaminated. Right now, the amendment that I offered was watered down in the United States Senate, and so the funding is available only for water contamination. Saying that it's a hazardous substance, making it eligible for a Superfund site cleanup, would mean any kind of contamination could be remedied. And that's why I'm very hopeful that the House of Representatives, which has in effect the amendment I offered in the Senate, will adopt that full amendment. And then in conference, maybe we can adopt a more expansive version of protection.
Now, as part of your amendment, I believe the military takes on some of the cleanup costs. Is that correct? And what kind of pushback are you getting from the military if it is?
The military has a very strong stake in the areas around its installations, including, for example, the facilities in Groton, the sub base, the installations that it maintains, and anywhere there is firefighting responsibility, there's likely to be PFAS foam chemicals used, because any place that has to put out a fire involving chemical or fuel needs this kind of foam, which in effect suffocates the fire. But there are alternatives, and so the military is going to have to do more to adopt those alternatives and also to clean up spills that it may create.
And we have had guests talk a little bit about the push for corporations and corporations really fighting against this. And that's why there's been no progress. That's why there's been a failure to regulate. What is your thinking on that?
There are probably industry sources that have been influential in Washington. My Republican colleagues may also be unhappy about the costs that could be incurred by the federal government if it's responsible for a new group of Superfund sites, assuming that PFAS are declared hazardous substances. But the industry really has to recognize it has a responsibility, and local, state, and federal officials, I think, can form a very powerful coalition for change. And that's why I'm very, very supportive of what the governor is doing. Governor Lamont is moving in a very important direction, and I want to be as helpful and supportive as I can be.
I know the governor, as we mentioned earlier, has set up this task force to look into the chemicals spilled into the Farmington River. I think they have an October 1 deadline. I can hear the voices of people who live in that area saying, though, October 1st, I mean, we have well water. We need help now, not 10 weeks from now.
Well, they're absolutely right, and I have heard those voices at the meetings that I've held in that area on the banks of the Farmington River. I've talked to residents, and they are rightly impatient and upset. That's why this measure, which provides, hopefully it will be passed in the House, but it provides right away assistance on those wells if they're hooked up to public water. The full cost will be funded. And so far as boating and other recreation are concerned, I'm hoping the state will act to remediate as well. But absolutely right that there should be action right away.
As we look at the wildfires, for example, in California, and we're seeing more and more of them, and we see the spraying from above to contain the blazes, have they changed the chemicals used in that foam, or are we just seeing these PFAS chemicals being sprayed over acre after acre to contain a fire?
I am very far from being an expert on firefighting or forest fighting, but remember that these foam fluorides or non-fluoride foams are used principally to fight chemical and fuel fires. That's why they are stored at hangars, at aircraft facilities, whether it's the private facilities like Signature or the military bases where fuels are used, or in firefighting services that serve towns and cities around the state. Forest fires are wood fires, obviously, and water and other kinds of chemicals are more readily used. So, again, not as an expert, but simply going by the limited knowledge I have, I'm not sure that these chemicals are as much a danger out there, but it's definitely something that we need to look into, and I think you're absolutely right to raise it.
When we look at the EPA and regulating PFAS, and you mentioned the Republicans and other lawmakers, I'm sure, concerned about the amount of money this is going to cost, whether it's remediation or reformulation, whatever it might be, this has the potential to be a massive issue when we talk about the fact that these chemicals are forever chemicals.
And that's why the bill and the amendment that I am advocating would provide support for research into fluoride-free alternatives, that is, non-PFAS-type firefighting substances, also aid fire services in the transition, because they're going to have to buy new chemicals and potentially new equipment. It would authorize the bill right now a $15 million a year program for the EPA to conduct that kind of research, and it would require the EPA to bar certain kinds of these PFAS chemicals right away. So it enables some very important first steps, including, as you mentioned, the Department of Defense to work with state and local utilities in testing, removal, remedial actions for PFAS that stem from DOD actions. The bill that we have passed in the Senate offers some very promising first steps. I'm hoping that a tougher bill in the House that incorporates my full amendment will pass there, and that the ultimate product will aid in the transition, because prevention, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
All right. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut updating us on the Farmington River spill and latest legislation coming in the Senate that he's introduced having to do with these chemicals. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Full Story.
Thank you. Take care.
And we'll be back with more after a break. This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran. This week, New York State health officials say they will set new drinking water standards for chemicals PFAS and 1,4-dioxane. 1,4-dioxane is found in household cleaning, cosmetics, and personal care products that are often dumped down the drain. The state promises $27 million to upgrade 9 water treatment facilities on Long Island to meet the new standards. A recent report released by the New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG, found that Long Island has the worst drinking water in New York. Liz Moran is NYPIRG's environmental policy director. She says setting strict standards is crucial to keep people healthy and prevent future water contaminations.
We highly recommend the state goes to the lowest level possible and revisits it down the road to see if it can be lowered further to best protect public health.
Joining us now is Adrienne Esposito. She's the executive director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment. The group has pushed for New York to adopt stricter drinking water regulations and hold polluters accountable. Adrienne Esposito, thank you for joining us today on The Full Story.
Well, thank you for having me.
Long Island has a unique problem with this in the fact that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that all of the drinking water on Long Island comes from Long Island.
Yes, it is a blessing and a curse. 100% of our drinking water comes from directly underneath our feet in something called a sole source aquifer. There's only about 12 of them in the United States of America. That means that 3 million people live and work and play right on top of our drinking water source. So what could possibly go wrong? So that means that we are very vulnerable to any type of activity on the surface that involves chemicals or pollution or dumping or even just pesticide application, because it all seeps down, goes underground, and it mixes with that underground water supply we rely on.
Now, the use of these chemicals has been for quite a long time, maybe since the 1940s. Why are we now just hearing more about it?
Well, in part because they were not tested for. They are what is now termed as an emerging contaminant, which means that they're just getting the data now. The EPA had mandated, for instance, with 1,4-dioxane, that water suppliers across the nation test once between 2013 and 2015. What CCE did, Citizens Campaign for the Environment, was we took all of that data that was being collected, and we looked at it for New York and Connecticut, and we found that Long Island has the highest levels of 1,4-dioxane of anywhere in the nation. And it's simply because it seeps underground and it stays there. It doesn't really dilute either.
Well, that's part of the problem with this group of chemicals is the half-life, the breakdown. Is that not right?
Yeah, you're right. They're very persistent in the natural environment, in both soil and in water. And that makes us very nervous, us meaning health officials, because what that means is that they don't break down. They build up in soil, and they also can build up in the ecosystem, for instance, if they're contaminated into fish or other species, and then they go up the food chain.
And they also build up in the body.
Yes, and then yes, absolutely. So, you know, the issue for us is we have to do two things, right? We have to clean up what's there, and we have to prevent additional contamination from occurring.
How big a job, though, is it to clean up what's there?
It's gigantic. I mean, there's a little good news. The good news is with the PFAS, PFOA, and PFOS, you can actually filter that out of drinking water with what's called a carbon filtration, which is your very standard, very traditional filtration system that we have across Connecticut and New York. They're not cheap, but they're not overly costly either. I've been told they're about $750,000 to $800,000 per wellhead. But many wellheads already have them because they are filtering and treating our drinking water for other volatile organic chemicals that exist. The bad news for 1,4-dioxane is very difficult and very challenging to clean up. In fact, the state wants this new technology called an AO, or advanced oxidation, to be used, and that is costly, and it's expensive, and none of the water suppliers have it yet because it is new. So one of the chemicals I feel like we can remedy as long as we know it's there and we can filter. The other chemical, 1,4-dioxane, going to be a very big challenge and a very big expense.
So for people at home who are listening to this, is this concern that if you use public drinking water or is it all drinking water?
It's all drinking water. It doesn't matter. What we're finding is that the detex of these chemicals, the emerging chemicals, are really widespread, and they're becoming ubiquitous. And it's not just our area. I mean, I think it's important to know that PFAS is a problem in 43 states throughout America. So this is really a national water crisis that's occurring. And the thing about the PFAS also is that it really is to be of concern about. It's such a big concern that it's measured in what's called parts per trillion, which is a very tiny measurement. And it's so serious that New York has just recently, yesterday, proposed a drinking water standard of the lowest in the nation of 10 parts per trillion. That is a very low amount, but it's based on numerous health studies and scientific studies about what exposure should be for us, for humans.
How has the EPA been in regulating and managing this?
Who? Well, the EPA literally has been asleep at the wheel, which is unfortunate, but it's also dangerous, frankly. You know, we expect better of them, and we need them to do better. But they really have virtually, actually had written to them. We had Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand write to them, ask for a drinking water standard of 1,4-dioxane, and ask the FDA to mandate that it be filtered out of these common household products. The FDA wrote back and said, no, we don't think we need to. And the EPA said, well, we're just not there yet to do a drinking water standard. So I think it's important for listeners to know, as serious as these chemicals are, there's no drinking water standard right now for these chemicals.
Is it just that there's not hard data to present to the EPA? or the FDA that says there's a direct correlation with certain health issues and problems as the result of ingesting these chemicals?
Yeah, no, I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is there's too much corporate influence in our federal government right now. And I mean, states across the nation, California, New York, and other ones, and even Connecticut, just announced the formation of a task force to look at PFAS with a deadline of October 1st to talk about what the drinking water standard should be. New York proposed a drinking water standard. They spent a year looking rigorously and thoroughly at studies, and other states are starting to do the same thing. So the states are out in front of the federal government. The federal government is supposed to be out in front and leading the states, and in this case, it's the opposite. So, you know, the good news is for the New York and Connecticut listeners, we're working hard to get on top of this. I'm very pleased that New York came out with their proposed standards of 1 part per billion for 1,4-dioxane, and as I said, 10 parts per trillion for PFAS. Those will be the lowest standards in the nation. There's a 60-day public comment period, and after that, the health department can make some adjustments, maybe make them lower, but then needs to codify them into law.
You brought up the influence of corporations. Though, has DuPont not said they are going to stop using some of these chemicals in their products?
You know, let me give you an example. We fought a tremendous battle here in New York State to ban 1,4-dioxane from common household products. Our organization, Citizens Campaign, tested independently with an independent laboratory, which was certified and is certified by the New York State Health Department, 80 different common household products, Tide detergent, you know, Dove body wash, shampoos, conditioners, dish soaps, laundry soaps. And we found that 81% of all the products had 1,4-dioxane, and not just a little bit, but a lot. So, for instance, Tide has 14,000 parts per billion. And the worst we found, believe it or not, was Victoria's Secret bath gels, 15,000 and 17,000 parts per billion. We like to say we now know her secret. She's poisoning us. But I think that the issue, and then the legislation got written, and I'm not exaggerating, every corporation in America, Lysol, Procter & Gamble, hit the streets of Albany, the halls of Albany, and worked against this bill. I'm happy to tell you we prevailed. And the bill passed the Senate 62-0. Now, it's almost amazing that an environmental bill would pass the Senate at all, but 62-0, and it passed the Assembly 111-2. The bill awaits the governor's signature. Right now, the industry is fiercely lobbying for Governor Cuomo to veto the bill. But this bill is very critical because, as I said earlier, we not only have to clean up what's there, but we have to prevent the continuing contamination from going underground.
Wait,
and
what
we
would
cannot
the
do that if we have products pouring it into the earth.
What would the bill do exactly?
The bill requires that common household products filter out or remove the 1,4-dioxane before they hit the store shelves. It allows them to leave a minuscule amount of 1,000 parts per billion, but all these other big numbers have to be filtered out.
So, Adrian, why are these chemicals in these consumer products to begin with?
That's an excellent question. I should have said that. It's actually not even an ingredient. 1,4-dioxane is a byproduct of the manufacturing process. So it's not even needed for the formulation. That's why so many of the products we tested, or 20%, didn't have 1,4-dioxane. What some companies do already is they'll filter it out before the product goes to the shelf. The FDA has an advisory document advising companies to do that. We asked them to make it mandatory. They refused. But that's why if you go to the store and you look at the back or the label, it's not listed as an ingredient because it's not an ingredient.
When you listed the products that have the 1,4-dioxane, I mean, this is so widespread. Many at home are thinking, well, I've been buying bottled water. Water comes in from overseas. Water comes in from Maine, from safe springs. Is any water source safe when you look at the widespread use of those consumer products?
Well, I don't think you can make an assumption that because the water's in a bottle that it's safe. Actually, the sad news is, and I hate to keep being the bearer of bad news here, but there's no rigorous testing for bottled water. So, you know, if you get the water from a source, or you look at some bottled water, it's from New Jersey, right? It's from Pennsylvania. Well, they use the same products we do. They have the same industry we do. So just because it's in a bottle, that doesn't mean it's clean and safe.
Are there hot spots that you are particularly concerned about, especially on Long Island, where you are seeing really, really alarming levels of this chemical in the water?
Oh, absolutely.
Where are they?
I mean, our data shows that, you know, 1,4-dioxane, for instance, is above the new proposed drinking water standard in many areas. Areas like Valley Stream, which had 12 parts per billion. Tana Hempstead, 10 parts per billion. Huntington, an area in Huntington, had 6 parts per billion. You know, with the PFAS, we already have Superfund sites that have been declared in Yaphank by the fire training facility in Brookhaven. The Gubretzky Airport, which is in East Hampton, another site in Southampton. We already have Superfund sites that have been declared state Superfund sites specifically because of the incredibly high levels of the PFAS. So we are, you know, very concerned. We are working aggressively. When I say we, I mean the nonprofit sector, but also agencies. I mean, I have to say this is not an issue that has been ignored by local health departments or the state. We led a grassroots movement to get these drinking water standards. I mean, we had thousands and thousands of members of the public write letters to the health commissioner and the governor asking for a drinking water standard, and they responded. I mean, they did. They got the letters. They heard the public's cries for help, and they got to action. And I think that's a very important thing to know here. Also, the state has been giving grants. The additional $27 million that they announced the other day is on top of tens of millions of dollars that have already come to the island to help with this water crisis. And there will be more to come. Many of the nonprofits have been lobbying hard in Albany for funding in the state budget for this issue, and that has been successful as well.
How long do you think it will take to remediate? If everything's continuing forward the way it sounds like there's a recognition now that we've got a problem, it's got to be fixed. How long do you think it's going to take to really get the drinking water to the point where we are going to have either no PFAS or 1,4-dioxane or acceptable levels?
I don't know. I don't know if anybody can answer that question. I mean, we have to continue. And the water companies do. They test. They're mandated to test by law. They test rigorously, and when drinking water that comes out of your faucet isn't meeting a standard, then they must filter. So that's why these drinking water standards are so critical, because it will require the filtration occur. So, but I mean, look, you know, I know many of them who work in the water supply industry. They're just as concerned as the rest of us, and they need these standards too, so that they can get to work.
All right, Adrian Esposito, you've been fighting the good fight. We want to thank you for joining us today as the executive director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment and the work that's being done to combat and change standards having to do with the chemicals PFAS and 1,4-dioxane. Thanks for joining us on The Full Story.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to speak with Newsday reporter David Schwartz about New York State's new strict standards for chemicals in drinking water. And we'll also have Professor David Tonjes from Stony Brook University to give us more information about the quality of Long Island's groundwater and find out what's happening with the toxic plume in Bethpage. What do you think about this? You can email us at tfs@wshu.org and on Twitter, we're at Full Story WSHU. And we're now on Instagram. at Full Story Radio. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran. Welcome back. Today we're talking about the quality of our water supply. Our last guest, Adrian Esposito, mentioned that this week New York State is adopting new strict drinking water standards. Joining me now is David Schwartz. He covers environmental issues for Newsday. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Let's start off with these standards. Tell me more about them and if you think they're tough enough.
Well, let me just tell you what the experts that I talk to think about. So 1,4-dioxane, it would be the first standard set in the nation, at one part per billion. That is higher than some advocates had wanted back in December when a panel of experts got together. And they were looking for a standard like 0.35 parts per billion, which would is the 1 in a million cancer risk for long-term exposure at that level. But one part per billion is what they settled on, you know, if looking at things like costs and how widespread it is. For the PFAS and PFOA, you know, the governor says that would be the strictest in the nation as far as the drinking water standard at 10 parts per trillion, which is really minuscule amount. But there are also, again, some advocates who say even at that low level, that's not strict enough, that no level of this is safe to be in the drinking water.
How does this work? I know that there's a 60-day, I think, comment period. And is this definite that these standards will become law?
All signs are pointing to it. So there's a 60-day public comment period, and then it's going to be codified. I mean, this is the way it has gone. Governor Cuomo has really committed to it publicly, and his staff have been on board and driving towards this level. You know, the real question is, when are they going to start enforcing it? When are they going to, you know, force water providers to notify their customers if the levels are exceeding that? When are they going to force them to do the treatment upgrades? Adrian Esposito was talking about how difficult 1,4-dioxane in particular is to remove from the water. I mean, you're getting astronomical estimates of how much this is going to cost for these wellhead treatment systems, you know, $840 million, which sounds like a large amount. But in more tangible terms, we're talking about water rates doubling for some people here.
Yeah, let me bring in to talk a little bit more about the difficulty of screening these chemicals. We have Professor David Tonjes joining us. He's a research associate professor at the Department of Technology and Society at Stony Brook University. Professor, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tell us more about these forever chemicals and what makes them so difficult to remediate and to eliminate.
Well, they're called forever chemicals because there are we have identified few natural ways that they degrade. So, for instance, in a groundwater environment, especially for instance here on Long Island, there's not a whole lot of chemical activity going on in most groundwater settings. So you would look for microbes perhaps to consume these chemicals, but because of the way they're structured, microbes don't find them palatable, at least microbes that we're aware of that are we think are in the aquifer, and so we see no way or we see few ways that these microbes are going to disappear naturally. So thus they're with us always, and the things that make them unpalatable to microbes often contribute to the difficulty in treating them. The molecules are complex and offer few ways for chemicals or treatment processes to either have them stick to things that would take them out of the water or that would break them apart into simpler molecules.
So for those of us that didn't ace our science exams,
right.
Nature has a way of cleansing itself in addition to, you know, what man can do. But nature has a way of cleansing itself, and you're saying nature just doesn't like these chemicals.
As far as we can tell. And you know, it's always surprising because, you know, we find a variety of man-made chemicals that particular microbes will eat, despite the fact that they're not naturally occurring. So, for instance, a couple of years ago, it was discovered that particular microbes will eat plastics, and yet plastics aren't natural to the environment. So, as far as we know, there seem to be few microbial processes that would consume these organisms, and because Long Island's aquifer is mostly sandy, we don't have a lot of microbes naturally living in the aquifer anyway. So there aren't many organisms there to begin with, and we don't think that those organisms will help to get rid of these chemicals.
So man has to remove them. David Schwartz,
yes. You
touched on this a moment ago about the cost for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I guess either as preventive and in cleanup. I think the average resident is starting to hear what the potential cost for them is going to be. And I think probably the municipalities are thinking the same thing. I mean, this is going to be very expensive, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I've toured some of these facilities where they're pilot testing or have installed treatment for 1,4-dioxane. There's only one approved for use on Long Island. It's in Central Islip. But there are others being tested out in Bethpage, for example. And what they do is they have to inject the water with something like hydrogen peroxide, and then they run it through these systems that blast it with UV lights, like you know, dozens of light bulbs, to try to convert the 1,4-dioxane, and then they have to run it through you know, carbon filtration systems. So you know, these are big problems and big engineering problems that they're trying to figure out.
And, Professor, are there studies that are currently going on that are tracking the impact these chemicals are having on us and on the environment?
Health assessments have been begun, but it's difficult to do these kinds of experiments. You know, we like to... If we're going to do a proper health risk assessment, we would like to look at an impact on an actual organism. So, for instance, you might want to treat some mice or some rats with various dosages of these chemicals, see what happens to them, and then infer from that what the impacts may be on us. And it's difficult because these chemicals, as was mentioned, are being regulated at very, very low levels. So you would want to test the organisms at relatively low exposures too, in order to see if you know, what the impacts might be on living organisms at low exposure levels. But that means you need to treat a lot of animals, or you need to repeat experiments over and over again in order to get reliable results. And that takes time. It takes money. And this sort of thing usually takes a while to develop. And then you need to figure out how to interpret the results that occur in the animals and what that might mean for people.
And
we aren't mice and rats after all.
And I'm sure people at home are wondering, okay, I've got my, you know, my water filter pitcher in my refrigerator right now. It's got a charcoal filter or a certain filtration system. Is that good enough to filter out the 1,4-dioxanes and the PFAS?
Charcoal filters will work okay on PFASs, yeah. You know, that's one of the ways that, for instance, a water provider would try to remove the PFASs. It's not very effective on the 1,4-dioxane. So in order for, in order, what your other guest mentioned was, you need to pre-treat water that's contaminated with 1,4-dioxane to break the 1,4-dioxane down a little bit into other chemicals that will stick to carbon. And you know, one of the problems with carbon home carbon filters is if you don't change them often enough, they will actually become a source of contamination to your water instead of a removal process.
So clean out those filters.
Can I just jump in?
Yeah, sure.
You know, because I do get it, and these are serious issues, and there's a reason that we're treating it. But I think we should emphasize that it's not like in Long Beach where they recently told people to boil water, where if you drink this, you're going to get instantly sick. These risk assessments, from my understanding, are based on long-term exposure here. So, you know, while this is a urgent issue and health advocates and water providers are looking at this as sort of this generational challenge that they're facing, you know, these risks are based on long-term exposures to these chemicals. So I think that's an important distinction.
And do you think, David, that David Schwartz, that perhaps that is why the EPA has not been proactive on this?
You know, I'm not going to speculate about what their motive is. I mean, I think you heard Adrian Esposito talk about why she thinks, and I hear that. I would note that under President Obama's administration, they did not set new maximum contaminant levels, and part of that is people are concerned about the costs, and so they're balancing all these things. You know, so as far as why the EPA is not, you know, the chemical companies point out that there are no human studies linking it. There are, you know, mice and rat studies linking it to adverse health effects in animals, but that's as much as I could go with.
Well, you talked about the concern during the Obama administration having to do with the cost. We touched on that briefly, but for municipalities, it sounds like this is going to have a huge, huge cost for them if there's limitations on what comes in from the state and what comes in from the federal government.
It is. I mean, the state announced, as you said, $27 million for, I believe, 9 water districts to get some treatment for 1,4-dioxane, you know, and that's $3 million each. But the cost, you know, they're projecting $840 million in costs, and these are very expensive to run each year. So they're definitely scrambling about how they're going to pay for this.
Let's shift gears here slightly and give folks an update on the Bethpage plume. Connecticut residents might not be as familiar with it. Professor, could you just give a brief two-sentence background on what exactly the Bethpage plume is and why it's a problem?
So Long Island was an early hotbed of aviation, and that resulted in a very successful company, Grumman Corporation, which made airplanes and aerospace and the lunar lander, among other things. And as part of industrial processes back in the mid to 1900s, organic chemicals were used to clean things, and they were often disposed in ways that we would not do today. And because of the way that the organic chemicals were disposed, they ended up contaminating the groundwater. And there's a very large complex plume that's approaching drinking water wells in that serve tens of thousands of people in the Bethpage Levittown area.
And I understand the plume, though, is moving. Explain to us, you know, what effect that has. As you say, I guess it's approaching these water supplies, drinking water supplies.
Sure. So water moves. Water moves because of gravity, mostly. And so, for instance, water flows essentially from the center of Long Island to the shorelines. And as the water moves, it tends to move downward too, because rain is falling on the land surface and accumulating in a layer on top of the water that was there already. And so this plume is moving from the Grumman facilities south towards the south shore of Long Island, and it tends to sink with time. And the fact that it's sinking makes it much more difficult to find and treat.
And David Schwartz, what are you learning in your reporting, your environmental reporting on Long Island, about the plume, its correlation to health issues, health concerns, and even about the cost of cleanup?
Well, the state released a plan, I think this spring, $585 million plan to try to contain it and treat it, which was a significant step. There was feeling from the Bethpage Water District and some residents there that the state had been slow, and the Navy and Northrop Grumman have been slow to contain the plume there. The state also released a health consultation, which looked at some test results from a well prior to 1976 and said because of some chemicals in there, one chemical in particular called TCE, there might have been adverse health effects from it. It is a reminder of the concern that's out there about the drinking water, and that we live over sole source aquifers where we get our drinking water, and it's this legacy of the industry that we've had here.
But these chemicals, Professor, these chemicals involved in the Bethpage plume, they're not the forever chemicals, are they?
Strictly speaking, no, but they take a very, very long time to degrade. The chemicals that we're looking at are solvents, and they're present in the heart of this plume at relatively low concentrations, 100 or so parts per billion. The organisms that like to eat these chemicals and that will eat these chemicals, that will change them into other chemicals, and then other organisms will eat those resultant chemicals, and finally we come to carbon dioxide down the chain. But the organisms that like to do this flourish best where there's no oxygen. And unfortunately, Long Island's aquifers tend to have lots of oxygen in them. And one thing you can do is have a lot of carbon in the aquifer, and then organisms will consume that carbon, and in doing so, we'll use up all the oxygen that's in the water.
We want to thank you both for joining us today, Professor David Tonjes. No problem. And David Schwartz from Newsday. Thank you both for joining us. That's our show for today. Thank you to all of our guests. And we'll see you next time on The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran.